Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 22nd. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and check in with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. Let's start this week with a story you reported, Cindy. One of the key providers of pediatric palliative care is ending its services here on Cape Cod.
Yeah, Hope Health is shutting its pediatric palliative and hospice care program on Cape Cod, just on Cape Cod. This is a Rhode Island-based agency, and they are keeping their services in the greater Boston area and other parts of southeastern Mass. But now these are the youngest and sickest patients are currently in the process of being transferred to Cranberry Hospice in Plymouth. Now, Hope Health is one of seven members of a statewide pediatric palliative care network. And that provides nursing, social services, sibling support, and pain management for children with life-threatening illnesses.
So this is palliative care, a little different than hospice care?
Yeah, they provided both the palliative care and the hospice care. And some of the children actually, sadly, transitioned to the hospice care, such as Andrew McLean of Sandwich, who died December 4th at age 17 of a rare lifelong genetic illness. And he stayed with his team all the way through. He had also had autism, so they had a communication specialist who was able to help him express his wishes for what kind of comfort measures he wanted, whether it was medications, a weighted blanket, lavender spray. His mother, Erin McLean, said he loved all that, loved being able to choose what he wanted. And now this announcement comes in the wake of Cape Cod Healthcare announcing in December that it is taking, that its Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod Hospice Program will be taking over the hospice, the Hope Health operations on the Cape, the hospice operations. And the VNA does have a pediatric hospice program, but it does not have this palliative care program for which you need a state contract with the Department of Public Health. So the palliative care is not currently being offered on the Cape, and families have to transition over to the Cranberry Hospice Fragile Footprints Program.
And that is off Cape, as you say.
That's off Cape. And there are 17 children who will have to make the transfer at this time. And their families aren't really happy because they've established relations with the people from the Hope Health program. I was visiting a little girl. She's just about three, Josephine McCarthy in Sandwich. She has a rare immune disorder and can't leave the house without a mask. But at home, she doesn't have to wear the mask. And she pointed to the nurse and social worker from Hope Health and said, "Those are my friends." Then she picked up her toy and said, "This is my doll." But so her mother isn't happy that they're going to have to switch. She also has a child who has benefited from the sibling support that's been provided. And so the family's going to have to change the whole relationship. But she is grateful that Fragile Footprints will take them. And a woman from Fragile Footprints said that, the Cape isn't too far away from Plymouth, and they already provide services on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard.
And what is Hope Health saying about why they're not providing these services anymore?
The spokesperson just said their contract is up in June, and they decided that the children would be better served by Cranberry Hospice. And now, in the meantime, Cape Cod Healthcare is saying that it does plan to have its VNA program apply for this contract the next time it becomes available.
And when would that be? Do they know?
I'm not sure. I asked the state. I didn't quite understand the answer. It's a whole complicated process. But this will be the VNA apparently applying for the contract to provide the palliative care. And some children do go off the palliative care. If they have cancer and the cancer goes into remission, thankfully they graduate from the program. But for other parents whose children have a life-limiting and potentially life-ending illness, they want to stay with the same team throughout.
And this Plymouth provider, Fragile Footprints, they already provide palliative care for services on the islands, is that right?
Yeah, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard.
Let's talk about one of the Barnstable County commissioners who was back in the news this week after a Twitter post that has created a lot of reaction and seems to be increasing as the week goes on, some of this reaction. This is Ron Beatty. Start by telling us about the post itself.
Okay, well, this is, Barnstable County Commissioner Ronald Beatty Jr., this is his latest outrageous behavior, according to people who are commenting on him. And he tweeted on Tuesday, he questioned gay politicians. quote, self-absorbed and self-centered, unquote, to properly serve all constituents. Now, this post came less than a week after two openly gay officials from the Cape and Islands, that's State Senator Julian Sear, a Democrat from Truro, and State Representative Sarah Peek, a Democrat from Provincetown, were named to leadership positions on Beacon Hill. Now, Beatty is saying that, you know, he wasn't directing that at anyone in particular, you know, but it's caused outrage, and this is just like, it's kind of the straw that has broken the camel's back for a lot of people.
Well, it did seem like when this first came out earlier in the week, people were saying, oh, this is not okay, this is not okay. And now there seems to be a little bit more of a groundswell of people trying to respond to it, including a letter written by the Cape's delegation yesterday, or a letter that
several members of the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates are asking him to step down. And Brian O'Malley of Provincetown, he's a member of the he represents Provincetown on the Delegate Assembly. He called for Beatty to be censured. And John Oman, who's also a delegate, he's from Dennis, said at a meeting this week that Beatty's continuous outrageous behavior has no place as an elected official of Barnstable County. He is a constant embarrassment to the citizens of this historic county.
And Ronald Beatty is saying what about this?
Well, he's saying that, you know, he had directed this at no one in particular. And he just said that he, you know, he's just within his rights to express his free speech. As a matter of fact, there's someone from the Linda, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, Linda Zern of Bourne, who is a delegate, said that the reaction against Beatty is a witch hunt. He has a right to have free speech. If people don't like it, don't vote for him. And Beatty has made a ton of other disparaging remarks about citizens and government officials, and
including one of the victims of the Parkland shooting.
Yep, Parkland shooting. He said disparaging comments about the Me Too comment. He also drew national attention with a proposal to kill great white sharks with baited drum lines after a young man died this fall up in Wellfleet, was killed by a great white shark. And he's just saying these things to get attention. That's what people question. Does he just want attention, even if it's negative attention? Mm-hmm. And what does this do to the county's reputation? And what does this do to the process of governance? I mean, if you are a commissioner, you're supposed to be governing the county.
And representing the county.
And
that's one of the things
that
the delegation is pointing out in their letter there, which is that he's representing a historic county and feel like he's not representing it adequately.
Right. It's certainly not indicative of the majority of people's, you know, thoughts and feelings about all these matters. But he's been in bigger trouble in the past. He served a federal prison term for threats against President President George H.W. Bush. So, you know, he's it's an amazing story, actually.
And there has been some question. Now, this has renewed some questions about how do you any effort to remove him as a commissioner. And it turns out that's not an easy thing to do.
It's not an easy thing. It might be, some people are feeling it might be just best to wait for the next election to come up.
Jeff Spillane's article today points out that when the county commissioner body was created, there was no provision put in there for removal of a county commissioner, but that somebody had questioned it when that was created a while ago. And it turned out the person who questioned the absence of any provision for removing a commissioner was actually Ronald Beatty many years ago.
Irony.
So the story comes all the way around.
Right.
We're going to speak right now with Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Holly.
Morning, Steve.
Holly, towns on the island, as elsewhere in the region, are feeling their way forward with regulations around the sales of recreational marijuana. There are some initiatives for their upcoming town meeting warrants there on the island. Bring us up to date on this.
Yeah, so two towns, West Tisbury and Edgartown, will both be considering warrant articles at town meeting that would change zoning bylaws to allow for the sale of retail marijuana in the airport business park, and that's the commercial area around the airport in the middle of the island that borders those two towns. So as you said, this is just kind of the latest development in towns figuring out how to regulate this new substance that's now legal.
How did the island vote in – how did these towns vote in the 2016 referendum on this?
Yeah, well, the feeling toward marijuana is kind of mixed on the island. The question in 2016 of whether to legalize adult-use cannabis for people who are over 21 passed overwhelmingly. In three towns on the island, it got more than 70% of the vote, and in the other three towns, it got more than 60% of the vote. But since – it was legalized, there's been a lot of concern from some residents about the fact that this is a tourist community. So substances that maybe are safe for people to use in their own homes and their own communities, maybe they cause more reckless behavior when people are on vacation. There's also concern, of course, about youth use on the island. We already have high rates of youth marijuana use. But there's also an acknowledgement that this is, marijuana has been on Martha's Vineyard for decades and is already widely used. And what's changing now is that it's above board and being regulated.
There are still some questions about how marijuana gets to the island, in that it would have to cross federal waters or airspace. Is that right?
Right. So being an island, you do have to cross federal waters to get here. And the Coast Guard has said we will follow federal law, which is that marijuana is illegal, and we will enforce that federal law. It's hard to imagine ferries getting stopped and searched in the middle of the Sound, but that's what the Coast Guard says, that they will adhere to that law. At the airport manager did ask the Federal Aviation Administration if they would still be in compliance if there were to be retail marijuana establishments in the airport business park. And the Federal Aviation Administration responded and said the airport would still be in compliance, and they didn't see a problem with that. So far there are no actual proposals to create marijuana establishments on the island that are for adult use recreational cannabis. We do have one medical facility that's under construction and is expected to open in late spring.
Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Holly, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
Thanks, Steve.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, it looks like Cape Cod will be getting its own police academy. We've talked about this a bit as it was in the idea stage. Now, an important state board has signed off on it.
Yeah, this is the Massachusetts Municipal Police Training Committee. You voted unanimously to approve this police training academy, which will be on the Cape, which will be located at Joint Base Cape Cod. And it is expected to welcome its first class as up to 45 recruits on July 8th.
This is a big deal for local police who have been looking to have an easier way to train recruits.
Yeah, they say that there's oftentimes waiting lists and they have to send recruits as far away as Springfield. And it's interesting because Nantucket Police Chief William Pittman said that there was skepticism that this could be pulled off as quickly as it was. But he's thrilled because he said that it's cheaper to buy ferry books, these, you know, passenger books for recruits than housing, because then people can go back and forth to the island. So this will be it'll be efficient cost savings and able to get recruits in for training faster than currently.
And the Barnstable County is supporting this. They've come up with some money to help this program get started.
Yeah, the Barnstable County Board of Regional Commissioners has included $50,000 in the fiscal 2020 budget for startup costs. Now, Barnstable County will finance the academy for a while. It's expected to run a deficit for the first year, but the expectations are that will eventually become a revenue-generating enterprise and take people from if there's room left over, if there's spots left over, the people on the Cape and Islands will get first preference. Mm-hmm. But after that, they can take people from off Cape and also self-identified potential recruits, people who are coming out on their own and saying, I want to do this. And the tuition is about $3,000 to $3,500.
And it sounds like the instructors are going to be selected from the local community or the local police community.
Yes, the instructors will be selected from the local police community. And Peter Carnes, who's retired Yarmouth police chief, will be the director. Now, the assistant director had his career in Shrewsbury. He's retired. That's Wayne Sampson. He's a retired Shrewsbury police chief. But instructors are expected to be from the Cape and Islands, and also they will have to be certified. They'll have to be approved, as instructors.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, there's a discussion underway in the Monomoy School District about whether to phase out Spanish in the elementary schools, and it would be replaced possibly by an emphasis on science. This is an interesting conversation. Tell us about this.
Sure. Now, the Spanish teachers at Chatham and Harwich Elementary School have been told they may not have a job next year because the school committee is, as you say, considering replacing the language with an expanded science and STEM curriculum. The proposal came out of a recent strategic planning session that looked at what skills students who are going to be graduating in a decade from now, or longer, or late, or beyond that, would need. And superintendent of schools Scott Carpenter said that basically the conclusion was that more science and technology education is going to be needed, you know, given the changes that we've seen in those areas just in the past couple of decades. Spanish, which is only taught part-time at the elementary school, wasn't initially targeted to be replaced. But an analysis showed that the number of hours of instruction in the language that students receive through both elementary and middle school doesn't really prepare them adequately for high school level Spanish. It's very rote and very limited. The current level of instructions in science also doesn't reach what educators say is the recommended level of at least 25 to 35 minutes a day at the elementary level. And the director of curriculum for the Monomoy District, Mark Smith, said, you know, there are only so many hours in the day, and if we want to increase the concentration in one area, in this case, STEM and science, we need to. There's got to be some give in some other area. So what they're looking at is more of an integrated approach to science and STEM, mixing it in with other subjects in the curriculum in a way that increases kids' exposure to that those subjects to something like 3 hours a week. And they're also considering hiring a specialist to support the elementary teachers in the subject. Elementary teachers tend to be pretty much generalist, and these days science and STEM are pretty specific mm-hmm. Subjects. So they need some support there, they feel. Now, the idea of Spanish being supplanted by science and STEM hasn't been very popular with parents. A survey of 223 families showed that 56% wanted to keep Spanish at the elementary level. And the school committee, on the other side of things, the school committee seems to be leaning in favor of the proposal to phase it out and incorporate more science and STEM in the curriculum starting next year. And they'd be looking at adding or at least altering the budget, next year's budget, in order to do that. They haven't made a final decision yet, but we're expecting that within the next few weeks. They have to decide their final budget by mid-March. So they'll be making those decisions in the coming weeks.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. A driver of a snowplow is facing charges that he intentionally sprayed a group of protesters with snow and ice.
Yeah, this is 31-year-old Mashpee resident John C. Pimental, who has a contract to plow for Falmouth. However, he's according to police, Falmouth Police Lieutenant Douglas Costa, Pimental is assigned to the Woods Hole area. And the village green where this incident took place is not part of his plow route. What happened was there were 55 demonstrators who took to the green on Monday, President's Day, to protest President Donald Trump's declaration of national emergency. That's to secure funding for the southern border wall. Now, what's interesting, and this is also caught on some, you know, people were filming
video,
and witness reports, is that that Pimental sprayed these protesters with slush and ice, and that he actually sped up as he approached the town green, which is this village green, which is a triangular shaped wedge of land. And then on the St. Barnabas side of the St. Barnabas church side, he crossed a yellow line, dropped his plow blade, according to witnesses, and sprayed snow, water, and ice on the demonstrators. And then he parked his truck nearby and came back 10 minutes later, according to witnesses, on the other side near the Bank of America, hugged the curb and threw water chunks of snow and ice with his plow blade. And demonstrator Cyril Dawson said that she actually had to turn her back so she won't get in the face, and her entire legs and back were soaked.
There were about 55 demonstrators, as you said there, and one of them is pointing out that It's generally an older crowd there.
Yeah, Sandra Fayman Silva, she was an organizer of the protest, said that, and she was one of the people to file a police complaint, said the average age of the demonstrators is over 65 years old and that they have a right to peacefully demonstrate, that they were, you know, out there exercising their rights as American citizens.
Well, and demonstrator Peter Wasdorp here is quoted as saying that he's a little bit concerned that the whole incident is going to overshadow the reason why they're out there demonstrating. But then another demonstrator who was quoted in this article is pointing out, interestingly, that she was concerned that the repercussions for this, for the plow driver, could make him even angrier in this whole conversation.
Right.
There might be ways to approach this in a better, more constructive way.
Yes, that she was afraid that, you know, if he got fired, that would just get him more angry and not rational about this. So she would actually like to see if there's any kind of repercussions, it be community service and have also a discussion about why people have a right to exercise their rights to freedom of speech.
She was saying, really, it would be great to have him be able to come meet with the protesters and
right.
have that conversation.
Have a talk, right.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, town officials are looking at proposals for what to do with a piece of land that now has a fire station. The station is about to move into a new facility.
It is. The new fire station is going up on Fairgrounds Road in the Mid-Island area. The current Pleasant Street fire station property will be... town officials have to decide what to do with that. They're looking at a number of different options, and late last week they got a look at a proposal for a mixed use of affordable housing, retail, and office space on the 1.2-acre lot. The plan, concept plan right now calls for 30 housing units across 8 buildings, 6 of which would be a mix of housing and retail or municipal space. So the select board members who got a look at that last Wednesday liked what they saw, at least conceptually. They voted unanimously to continue examining the feasibility of the project, but it's not unanimous across the board as to how town officials feel about this. A member of the town's Historic District Commission, the Architectural Review Board, took a look at it. It hasn't been before the HDC yet, but she took a look at it, Val Oliver, and I had some concerns. She said that the design, something she sees maybe in Boston, but not necessarily on Nantucket, that three-story curved buildings with flat roofs are common in the city, but not so much here, and she really felt it was inappropriate. But again, some of the select board members said they liked the idea. They liked the density of the housing in the Mid-Island area, which is a walking area now with the Stop and Shop supermarket, other shops and restaurants, and they felt that the needed affordable housing, and everybody agrees the island needs affordable housing, should be in an area like this and maybe not in some of the more outlying areas of the island. So they're going to keep looking at this. The group that brought this plan forward, the Town's Affordable Housing Trust Fund, said it's really just a jumping-off point. The design is to be discussed. Lots of community input is going to happen, and they'll make a decision down the road about what goes on this property.
Josh, the search for a new superintendent for the island's schools appears to have hit an impasse.
It does. It appears that it's back to square one, the search for a new school superintendent to replace Michael Kozort, who had announced his plans to retire at the end of the school year, is starting over again, basically. After the top choice of three school committee members withdrew his name from consideration on Tuesday afternoon, and Tuesday evening the school committee was planning to narrow down the search from four to potentially two or even a single candidate. But David Buck, who is the superintendent of a Missouri school district, dropped out, and three of the school committee members said that they really couldn't vote for any of the other three finalists and would like to start over again. So the school committee voted, realizing that they didn't have a consensus on any of the other candidates, to suspend the search for now, reopen it. That could potentially happen in the fall. The school committee chairman, Dr. Tim Lepre, said, get this school year out of the way, the summer out of the way, but that could change as well. They might discuss perhaps reopening it sooner than that. But as for now, the superintendent search is at an impasse.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. The state is looking to intervene in the possible sale of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station to a company that wants to decommission the power plant after it closes.
Yes, State Attorney General Maura Healey and the Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary Matthew Beaton have filed a petition to intervene in this, the review of the proposed sale and license transfer of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which is scheduled to close May 31st. Now, Entergy, the organization that owns Pilgrim, owns and operates Pilgrim, wants to transfer the license to Holtec International, which says that they can do the decommissioning like lickety-split and on schedule, on time, even have money left over to spare. And state officials aren't quite buying that. They're concerned that taxpayers will be left holding the part of the bill, that they're not accounting for costs that are associated with time delays and discovery of potential radiation at the site. And they also want an environmental review done of the site, which Entergy is not interested in, but they are very interested in.
So when you say lickety-split, the company Holtec is proposing to decommission this plant in about 8 years.
About 8 years, right.
Whereas the current owner, Entergy, says if they were going to hold on to it, they could hold on to it for decades and essentially take up to 60 years to complete the decommissioning. So
right, right. So that's sort of something that's people are really, it'll be there for 60 more years.
Right. So you can understand why a lot of people say, oh, we want to see this license transfer to Holtec happen because it would decommission the plant and reclaim that area much quicker. The state attorney general and the energy and environmental affairs secretary here saying, wait, there's a lot of questions, particularly around the finances of this, and they want those answered.
Right, right. They're wondering if this fund set up to decommission it will actually be enough. And this state petition says that Holtec's cost estimate is precisely that, an estimate, not a guarantee.
And it's the NRC that gets to sign off on this, and they said they're going to take all of this under advisement and decide whether to have the hearing in answer to this petition from the state.
Right. And he said, in the case of the state, you automatically have standing, have to have standing in this. But he said, and the state also wants a hearing on this, but he said, this is NRC spokesman Neil Sheehan. He's saying that even if the hearing is granted, it doesn't necessarily mean the license transfer would be delayed. It could be approved and conditions attached retroactively. And as I mentioned, Holtec and Entergy have requested an action on the license transfer by April, which is coming up very soon.
Let's speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve and Cindy.
Good morning.
Ed, let's start with a brief update on the select board race there, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The election was yesterday. Tell us about the outcome.
Well, the John Golden, who is the 62-year-old self-employed wallpaper hanger and longtime member of the Provincetown Planning Board, won the special election by a vote of 582-181 over Michaela Carew Murphy, the 31-year-old manager of the restaurant here, Sal's Place. It was fairly one-sided result. Golden said last night, "I'm overwhelmed by the amount of support. I don't know if you'd call it a landslide, but it's pretty good. I'm heartened by it." Meanwhile, Carew Murphy said that it was hard to say how she feels just yet. She's a little battle fatigued, but she's happy that it got so many people out regardless of the outcome. And it was a very good turnout for a special election. 765 voters, I think, is the largest turnout for a special election in quite a few years.
Ed, I want to ask you about a question you had, a story you have on shellfishermen and shellfishermen having concerns about a new initiative to reexamine the rules around the aquaculture industry statewide. Tell us about this and the recent state meeting out there on the Outer Cape, the recent meeting there.
Yes. So what we're talking about here is the Massachusetts Shellfish Initiative, something I don't think we've discussed on the Roundup before, but it's something that is a topic of tremendous interest out here, especially on the Outer Cape, where the shellfish industry is so important. There's quite a bit of confusion surrounding it. A lot of people don't quite know what it is. But its origins are in a series of discussions that have been taking place for some years now among several different groups, including the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, which is based in Chatham, the Massachusetts Aquaculture Association, the Nature Conservancy, and the State Division of Marine Fisheries. And they've been concerned for a while about a number of issues relating to aquaculture here. And this is actually part of a national movement. There are a number of states, other states, that also have shellfish initiatives. And the issues basically have to do with economic, social, and environmental benefits from aquaculture and shellfishing, and problems with really making those benefits happen. So, for example, more and more places are talking about shellfish reef restoration efforts as a way of improving, you know, environmental conditions, preventing, you know, storm surges and cleaning the water. Actually, we know that oysters, in particular, have a tremendously beneficial effect on the health of estuaries. And there's been a great increase in the amount of shellfishing and aquaculture that has is going on, and that has raised some economic issues, such as the fact that the supply of shellfish has been increasing really faster than the demand, and that has been depressing prices. Now, this, of course, has shell fishermen themselves upset, and in Wellfleet in particular, a lot of the local shell fishermen are suspicious of this whole thing because they see it as a possible sort of takeover of the industry by bigger organizations. There was a meeting last week in East Ham.
And Ed, let me jump in here because we're going to have to step away. But I want to you have another meeting coming up in Wellfleet on this. Is that right?
There's a meeting this Monday at 7 p.m. at the Council on Aging of the Wellfleet Shellfish Advisory Board. And it's for sure a number of the local people will come out and express their concerns about this initiative, and representatives of those groups that I named earlier will be there to talk about what it really is and how they want people to get involved coming to the table and talking about these issues.
And folks looking for more information on that can find that at the Provincetown Banner. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And Cindy, in Wellfleet, an examination for contamination at the site of a former military base is approaching an end. And officials there say it seems to be a positive report.
Yeah, this is Camp Wellfleet, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says that preliminary sampling indicates there are no issues with regard to contamination. That's according to Gina Queso, Army Corps Projects Manager. And this base was used from 1942 to 1961. It was a U.S. Army anti-aircraft training site in the early 1940s, a Navy missile testing and mobile radar training site in the mid-1940s, and also Army-trained guardsmen and reservists there from 47 to 61 when it became part of the Cape Cod National Seashore.
And they're looking for some specific contaminants here, and they've been doing this for a while. They don't have a final report, but they have a preliminary report that indicates that they haven't found anything.
Yeah, a final report is scheduled to be released in late spring. And they say that there's just like preliminary sampling, you know, indicates no issues with regards to contamination. Now, at these formerly used defense sites, they're called FUDs, and Camp Wellfleet is a FUDs, that they look for things like potassium perchlorate, barium, lead, copper, lots of other things. And this perchlorate was found on Camp Edwards in the Upper Cape, and there's, you know, been huge cleanup efforts there. So, but here, this looks like it's pretty clean. They say that the old munitions and scrap debris were removed more than 10 years ago, and it's not considered a high priority as a risk to human safety.
We're going to speak right now with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Brian, you've got a nice profile of the president and CEO of the island's hospital. She's been on the job now for just about a year.
Yeah, so Denise Schipici took over about a year ago, and she has been doing a pretty good job at the hospital after sort of a tumultuous year. She's really focused on opening up the hospital and being very transparent with the public, because that's something that the people on the island have really wanted. She hired a communications director, and she held a forum too last summer to kind of talk to people about the hospital's future plans and what they're going to be doing. She also has focused on hiring more primary care doctors, which has been a huge need on the island at the hospital. And yeah, things have been going pretty well for her. She's also working with Island Healthcare, which is another healthcare facility on the island, to kind of come up with this healthcare collaborative and create a needs assessment for the island to determine basically the island's public health needs.
And she identifies one of the challenges they're facing there is long-term nursing care and how they deal with that.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a lot going on at the hospital, and she is, you know, at the head of it, and she feels pretty good about things. There's also a big kind of master plan for the hospital. They're looking to switch things around and create more space for nurse practitioners and primary care doctors so people don't have to wait as long and they get better service.
Brian, another story you have at the Times there is about affordable housing, which is a big issue on the island as it is all around the region. There's an effort to get a housing bank up and running, and that's looking at the short-term rooms tax as a possible funding source. The Edgartown Select Board weighed in on this week. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so that short-term rental tax that just got passed in January has really affected the Cape and Islands especially. And this housing bank is looking to take, they're going around to each island town to take 50% of that revenue, which is, some of it's new because some of it comes from Airbnb rentals, VRBO rentals, but it also comes from the hotel tax that towns have been collecting for quite a while now. Edgartown specifically makes about $1 million in tax revenue just from that tax on hotels. And so they kind of stepped back and were a little nervous saying, hey, we don't really want to sign on to this so quickly. We want to kind of see how much money this expanded tax is going to bring into the town. Because if we just give you 50% of our tax revenue from hotels, you know, that's $500,000. So this essentially the town wants to make an extra $1 million with this Airbnb tax just to break even.
And this is the housing bank that's looking to access some of these funds that are being going to be raised and the taxes collected off of these short-term rentals.
Yeah, exactly. And with that money, they want to build year-round housing and just basically housing that a lot of people can afford.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Cindy, state lawmakers are looking at increasing the tax that's collected when property is bought and sold, and some of that could be money that would come back to the county.
Yeah, there are several bills on Beacon Hill that would significantly increase property transfer excise taxes and recording fees. One bill is called an Act Relative to Community Preservation Act Funding, and it could increase the real estate transfer excise taxes in Barnstable County. They're already the highest in the state, by the way, but the state excise tax would increase by $1.58 up to $5 per $1,000 of sale price. Now, when you combine that with the Barnstable County deeds excise tax of just over $3 per $1,000, the new rate would be just over $8 per $1,000 of sale price. And so obviously there's realtors are opposed to this, but the bill says that a good chunk of this money would go to county government. 16.5% from the excise tax rate would go to the increase would go to the Community Preservation Act fund, and the remaining money would go into the state coffers.
Now, you mentioned there are a couple of other bills looking at the same potential tax property, a tax on property transfers.
Well, State Senator Julian Cyr, a Democrat from Truro, and State Representative Dylan Fernandez, a Democrat from Woods Hole, have filed bills, separate bills, to establish statewide transfer taxes on property sales of more than $2 million and $1 million, respectively, and that's to fund affordable housing. And even Governor Charlie Baker is getting in on this proposal for hike increases in real estate transfer fees. He would like to see it increased by $2 per $1,000 of sale to fund climate resiliency projects.
And as you mentioned, the real estate people not happy with the idea of increasing a tax on the sale of property.
Yeah, Justin Davidson, he's the general counsel for the Massachusetts Association of Realtors, said that they will lobby against this. And it's just, he said, singling out a small portion of the population. They're in favor of climate resiliency projects, but should be borne by the entire community. And they said their concerns is that this would, these bills would drive up the cost of housing and also strip equity from the seller. And they say it's unfair. And he's even opposed to the proposals to put more taxes on luxury properties. He's saying there are a lot of second homeowners on the Cape Cod, and it's unfair because they're not able to vote on the issue. They don't live here, and so it's not fair to them.
Sandy, the state has a relatively new civics education law. You went into some classrooms to see how civics is being taught now and heard some concerns about what the new law might mean for teachers and for students.
Yeah, well, at Nauset Regional High School, civics is hugely popular. Michael McNamara started the class a few years ago with 14 students. Now it's half of the freshman class, and it involves a big project called Witness to War, where the students interview veterans, military veterans, living veterans from World War II, from Iraq, and then they create this oral history project. And in addition to learning about the Electoral College and the House and Senate whips and all the nuts and bolts of government. Now, the new state law would require a civics project at the eighth grade level, a student-led project at the eighth grade level, and also another one in high school. And the concern here is that this would strip, when you have schools that are doing a great job, it would strip, it would take the steam away from how could you do a project in ninth grade, after you've already done one in eighth grade. And the other thing is that there's an element of student choice at Nauset. One of the reasons students are enthusiastic about it is because they're choosing to take this class, and many will go on to take an AP government class. It's kind of whips up enthusiasm for that. And what will happen when this is a mandated thing now? It hasn't gone into effect yet, but what will happen as this is a mandate?
This is a new requirement, as we said, and teachers had some questions about this, and there was somebody from the state there to try to help them understand what's going on.
Yeah, Michelle Ryan from the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education traveled to the Cape late last month. She met with a teacher forum in Sandwich. It was a teacher from the surrounding areas and school administrators and described what was going to happen. And she also went up to Orleans in the late afternoon and met with a public meeting of people at the Wasatch Nauset Regional School Administrators Building. Now, and there are already changes. Some of the concerns are how will this alter lesson plans? And Michael Welch, who's the chairman of the Sandwich High School History and Social Sciences Department, said the teachers also want to know: Are these civics now going to be included on this? On these high stakes standardized testing? What's going to happen? How do we put this into the curriculum when there are so many demands on the curriculum already? And Sandwich already has made changes. The school committee approved having a U.S. government elective course next school year. And then eighth graders won't be taken World History 1. They'll be taken a U.S. civics course. And then World History 1 will be combined with a 10th grade course for a year-long course in world history in 2020-21 in the Sandwich School. So already changes are taking place in the school districts.
Cindy, in Truro, some condominium owners can now live there year-round. This is a change, a lifting of a seasonal use restriction that used to be in place.
Yeah, there was a Stone's Throw Condo Association in Truro is one of the first to benefit from this new town bylaw amendment that was approved by a town meeting last year. And that allows the condos to convert to year-round use. Of course, they have to meet local building, health, and safety codes. But, since the 1980s, the town had a restriction on the year-round use of condos because a lot of motels and condos were being converted into condos. And they were afraid of the summer cottages, right. And they had kitchens and they have septic and they're like, what is this going to do to our infrastructure? Can we afford this? But now the thinking is, well, we need affordable housing in Truro very badly. So this was approved that they can switch to the year-round use. And there were 515 condo units that were required to be vacant from December through February.
And now the owners of these condos can apply to be there year-round, or the condominium associations on an association-by-association basis.
Right, exactly. And the Board of Selectmen approved the application of the Stone's Throw condominium January 22nd. And that's delighted condo owners such as Lisa Baum and Irene Gray. They sold their house in Saratoga Springs, New York, a move full-time to Stone's Throw, on Shore Road, in November of 2017, kind of hoping something like this would happen because they had to move out for 3 months of the year and go into a rental in Provincetown. And so they say this is their slice of paradise. This is where they want to be. So they're totally thrilled with it. And James Landry, who is a condo trustee, also moved to Truro full-time and started a business. That was after he was laid off with 29 people from a bank where he used to work. And he said that the developer of Stone's Throw did have foresight and foresaw this happening because the property is fully winterized and there are full basements. So really, when they made the switch to year-round, it was really like a paper application process. They really didn't have to do much in terms of upgrading or improving the condo units.
Some not very good news for fishermen, as a recent assessment of the striped bass stocks seems to indicate that the species is being overfished.
Yeah, this is from the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission at a meeting this month. They said a computer simulation model shows that the striped bass were overfished for 2017, and the fishermen are still catching too many to sustain the population. And this is part of a deeper benchmark assessment by the commission and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries. And what it does is it's more of a living document. It incorporates new information, so you really get an accurate picture of the fish stock, more accurate than an annual assessment.
It's long been thought that striped bass management was kind of a conservation success story. The stocks crashed in the 80s, and they've been brought back.
Right. There was a moratorium in the 1980s. It was a coastwide moratorium. But at this point, it's not as bad. It's like there's Michael Armstrong, who's the chairman of the Striped Bass Board, the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, said that the sky is not falling, stocks don't fall overnight. But there are steps that will have to be taken to...
What kind of steps are they looking at, are they talking about?
Well, for one thing, improving what happens, making changes so that when fish are actually thrown back, that they are more likely to live. Because right now, more than 9% of them die. And the interesting thing, there's a big debate between, of course, the commercial fishermen and the recreational fishermen. The recreational fishermen are like, no, there has to be a complete halt to commercial fishing. That's the problem. But interestingly, statistics show that the recreational fishermen are responsible for more of deaths of fish that are thrown back. Like, you know, there are millions of fish thrown back and about a million of them die, thrown back into the sea by commercial fishermen. So if there's a way that they can prolong the life of these fish so then they go back, they survive, that's one thing that they'll all be studied and looked at.
And right now, look, they are planning to make suggestions for changes in the fishing model for the year 2020, not this summer coming up.
That's right. Now the people from the striped bass associations wanted to declare it a game fish, and 5 of 15 coastal states have banned commercial fishing of striped bass. So that's also a consideration.
This has been a long running discussion between fishermen, striped bass fishermen,
yeah,
whether it should be a game fish only for recreational fishing, or a game fish and commercial fish, which it is right now, and how those different forces affect the striped bass population.
And they may also be affected by climate change, because there's some thought that the ocean temps near shore may be too warm for migrating striped bass, and it's forcing them offshore or deeper into cooler waters. And not all striped bass fishermen have boats, and striped bass fishing is prohibited in federal waters beyond the 3-mile state limit.
I want to ask you about a story reporter Christine Legere did this week, a nice story about a veteran who passed away recently. And the response from the community.
Yeah, there was an overwhelming response from the community. This was Airman Second Class Craig Ross Price. He had no next of kin when he died at age 80, November 2nd. The military family, he had a military family. 300 people turned out last Friday for his burial at the Massachusetts National Cemetery.
So he died with no next of kin, but the word got out on social media, and there was a big, big turnout from the military.
Yeah, a big turnout. The Patriot Guard riders came in force. They held American flags. They lined the walkways. His urn was carried to the shelter area there at the National Cemetery. Veterans from every service branch were represented. And one woman, Kathy Raymond from Yarmouth, even brought her 7-year-old daughter. She said it was important to pay their respects.
Before we close today, I want to say a word about the New England Newspaper and Press Association Awards, which were recently handed out for 2018. And once again, they highlight how well-served we are in this region by some great local journalism, the benefit of which our listeners get to enjoy here on the Roundup as we hear from local editors and reporters. Congratulations to all those who took home awards at the Cape Cod Times, at the Vineyard Gazette, at the Martha's Vineyard Times, the Provincetown Banner. That includes our guest today, Cindy McCormick, who won an award for reporting on tick-borne diseases. Cindy, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
And thanks to all our other contributors. We spoke with Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.